I am a woman, I am a Christian, I am a person who for over 20 years has been very much committed to what God wants in my life, and I struggle with the reality of submission.
This is Christianity at Work from Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. On today's program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and family therapist Christine Barber will continue the discussion on the biblical concepts of headship and submission. And we know these concepts are controversial. They've been misunderstood. They've been abused. Today, Jack and Christine will explore some of the reasons why we have difficulty dealing with and understanding them. Headship and submission. Let's listen.
Last week, we started our discussion on headship and submission. This week, we're going to talk more about it. But in order to do that, I think we need to define again what is headship and what is submission according to the Bible. So will you do that for us?
Okay. Fundamentally, the marriage relationship is a partnership between two equal human beings, equal in the eyes of God, equal in one another's eyes, but that it's a relationship where two very, very different people, very different finite people, are having to work on becoming one flesh. And so God has instituted, I think, a kind of an arrangement within the partnership where he has is putting the responsibility, the greater responsibility, the primary responsibility for the well-being and the working out of the relationship on one of the partners rather than the other. And that's what I understand the Bible to mean by headship. God has come to Adam, to the man, to the husband, and said, okay, you two are to become one flesh. When I come back, I'm going to be asking you how you did here. I'm going to hold you accountable. I'm going to hold you responsible for how this relationship goes. So do your job. Do the job of making sure that this relationship stays healthy. And I argued that what that means is that the husband has the greater responsibility to serve his wife, to love his wife, to submit to his wife's will and not insist on his own will in his own way, and to just generally be compassionate and loving and selfless in relationship to his wife. And that, I think, is headship.
I'd like to encourage people who are listening today and just heard that very brief definition to reference the tape that we have on submission. It would be first in our series, because it really does unpack a lot of what you said. And I think with your definition, rightly understood, it's an excellent one. Wrongly understood, it could be taken in a really bad direction,
yeah,
which I think submission often and headship often are. So I really would encourage people to listen to that tape and get a better context for what we're saying today. Many years back when I was an intern counselor, my supervisor, who was not a Christian, said to me, "How can you possibly be a Christian, Christine? Paul, especially in the Bible, and Jesus, really put down the place of women. How could you be such a less than person? How could you accept that less than position?" I think that is a common way of thinking about both headship and submission. And today I'd like to talk a little bit about why that is. Why do those concepts have such very sour tastes in our mouth?
I think there's two things at work there. On the one hand, I think there's just a misunderstanding. Oftentimes, the way headship gets articulated, it actually encourages the view of headship that is actually very perverse, that the husband is the master and the wife is the slave, that the husband is this god in their relationship and the wife is the worshiper who needs to serve the god. Those are just perverse concepts. But all too often, we are not clear enough on what the biblical concept of submission and headship are to put that those perverse notions to rest. So if we could intellectually kind of get clear on what really is the biblical concept, I think that would go a ways toward alleviating this really strong negative emotional reaction to it. But I don't think it would eliminate it completely, because part of our reaction to it, I think, is just rooted in our own sinfulness. As human beings, we kind of rebel against the idea that I can't be anything that I want to be, and I can't play any role that I want to play, that I actually have to bow to the dictates of God in that matter. That comes pretty naturally to us, to resist that and to rebel against that. So I think that's some of it as well.
I definitely think that's it. I think at the very core of our being, we want to rise up and be the one in charge, the one who calls the shots, the one who's powerful, and not have to give in to any kind of authority over us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can answer this better than I can, Christine. Is there a third element? Is there a lot of abuse of this relationship out of there that people, just from their own experience, go, headship, all that's ever done is brought grief? Do you see that?
I definitely do, though. I'd like to come back to that.
Okay.
Because I'd like to talk a little bit more about what we were just saying, that there's just this innate sense in us that doesn't want to bow to being less than all-powerful and kind of omniscient ourselves. I'd like to give some examples of that, because years ago I wouldn't have understood that at all, until I went through years of having to submit to my own limitations. I didn't understand how firmly I held to being in charge. The biggest submission that I have ever felt in my life came about, I think it was about 9 or 10 years ago, when I got cancer. What I realized then was that God had in his hands my life, that it was very real to me for the first time in my life that I was going to die, and that during that bout with cancer, I very well could have died. I remember walking into the doctor's office and him saying to me, this is a cancer that grows slowly, but if it has grown in you, you're going to die because we have no treatment for it. It's a rare form of cancer. I can't tell you what that did to me. It was like being on an airplane, and all of a sudden, the pilot came on and said, the engine is going to blow up in 2 minutes. All of a sudden, my life was not my own. That had a profound, profound impact on me. I had felt, without really knowing it, that I was really going to be okay, that I was really took for granted my own life. And at a very core level, I learned that I can't take for granted even my own life, that God does truly have it in his hands. And for that matter, what occurred to me was that he also had my children's life in his hands, that he could take my children's mother away. And that's where it hit me. It makes me very sad thinking about it. That's where it hit me most profoundly, was not only the loss of my own life, but more especially the loss of my children's mother. But God had that in his hands. I don't want to know that.
Yeah.
I don't want it to be so profoundly true. But I think that was the best gift I could ever have in my life, because it was a blanket over everything else. And it has, in a sense, made life come into perspective so very much differently than it ever was.
It probably engendered a sort of spiritual crisis of sorts.
Oh, not a sort of, but an incredibly huge spiritual crisis where I had to come up against, is God a good God?
Right.
I had to ask the question, does God love me? Am I going to allow God the right to take me away? Of course, he would, whether or not I gave it to him or not. But in my mind, in my psyche, was I willing to give that to him?
Yeah.
I think it was an essential part of my own growth process. Something that I'm so glad I have. Something that I am so glad I don't have to go on my life without. And on the other hand, I never want to have to face that again.
Right. Yeah, the pain of it is not at all fun, but the reward, the wisdom, the insight that we get about where I stand in all of reality is a treasure that is immeasurable.
It was the best gift I ever got.
Yeah.
It is immeasurable.
That what you had to come to right there is exactly, I think, what is described by the Greek word sophrosune in the New Testament. It's really hard to define. It's hard to even translate into English. But it's a basic fundamental attitude toward life and, from a Christian perspective, toward God, that it's that attitude of becoming okay with the prospect that God is the author of my existence and I am simply a character in his hands and his will. He makes my life. He puts the boundaries on my life. He gives me and grants me the role that I'm going to play in life. He tells me when I'm going to live and when I'm going to die and all that. That the authority that he has to be God is something that it's very, very difficult for us to come to terms with. And when we finally do, we have achieved that virtue called sophrosune.
And Jack, I think it takes a major crisis in our life, or maybe a number of small ones. But for all of us, it does take something very, very painful. And it usually doesn't happen at the beginning of our lives. As we look at our lives as young people, I think we are it's much easier to rebel because we haven't been humbled. And sometimes it feels like crushed, lovingly, by the hand of God.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. We'll return to Jack and Christine in a few moments. Some folks have asked us to say a bit more about our two participants. Christine Barber has more than 20 years of experience as a licensed marriage and family therapist. In addition, she and her husband Larry work with pastors who have experienced ministerial burnout or who have, for other reasons, left their ministries under adverse circumstances. Christine is committed to knowing and applying the truth of God's Word to everyday life. She has spent years working alongside others as they discover the truth of who they are and then try to pursue life with love and wisdom. She is convinced that true change in a person's life comes about through the miraculous work of God. Dr. Jack Crabtree is a philosopher by training, a Bible teacher, pastor, and professor by profession. If you spend a short time with Jack, you quickly learn he is a seeker of truth and a man with a deeply passionate love for God's Word. For years, he has studied and taught the Bible at the Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto, California, and Reformation Fellowship in Eugene. He has also taught at the University of Oregon and Oregon State University, as well as the McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. On a later program, we'll tell you something about our participants' personal lives, their families. But right now, it's time for us to get back to today's discussion.
I remember hearing a sermon one time, and I use it often when I speak, is that suffering is a good thing in the hand of a loving God.
As opposed to in the hands of an evil God.
Right.
Who's just being capricious and sadistic or something. Yeah.
I can see very much that God's dealing with me with cancer was not at all capricious and was, as a matter of fact, so incredibly loving, because for the first time in my life I got the understanding that of who God really is and my desire to submit to him and to understand who he is and to want his kingdom became very, very present in my life. It changed me. It helped me turn a corner. It opened a room to a door with fresh air that I'd never seen before. It brought me into a different reality that I can't teach anybody, that I can't tell anybody, except for I know that God is committed to doing that in our lives. But that kind of submission is so incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Some people don't understand. How could you, in the midst of being struck with cancer, come to the conclusion that God is a good God? Can you explain that?
Well, people said that to me because I would say it in the midst of not knowing if I was going to die or not. And there was a number of weeks and months and even years where it was not certain. And I lived with it's never certain actually, but I lived with the uncertainty more than I do today with that particular cancer. And I wish that I could explain it better. I'm not sure I can. I think it was a gift.
Yeah, I didn't actually expect that you could, because I do. I think it's miraculous. Another person in the same situation may very well just decide to curse God. I think there was a wife, Job's wife, suggested that to him in the midst of his suffering, that in a way it makes sense. You know, if God's going to treat you this way, then, you know, why don't we just curse him and die? But the miracle is that somehow we have our eyes opened to realize that the God who is performing this surgery on me, the surgery on my soul right now, is a good and wonderful God who has my best interest in mind. And it's a privilege to have him take me through this. It's not ultimately a tragedy. I'm privileged that he loves me enough, that he cares for me enough to begin to work on me and make me into his own child.
It is a miracle, because hearing that is something that's unbelievable to other people. And Jack, I'm certain that it would have been unbelievable to me standing outside of that circumstance.
Right.
And again, friends said that to me. They saw that it was real, and yet they marveled at it, as did I. I think I marveled at it and still do as much as they did, that could be true, that I actually thought that. Now, that's not to say that submission then is a done deal, that I don't have a difficult time submitting to what God wants in my life. Certainly I do. When I was younger, I very much prided myself on what I looked like. I think that's a common road that many women go down, and also many men, but women really do like to look beautiful. Many women do. And it's very much encouraged in our society, and I got very much attention and respect for that. Certainly as I've grown older, it's been an issue of submission to what God has for me. I'm not going to be a youthful person, and every day my face and my body tell me that. I could be bitter and angry toward God for taking that away from me, or I could submit to what God has for me. And what God has for me is not a beautiful face and not a beautiful body, because age will always take that away. What he has for me is a heart that wants to lean toward him. And to submit myself to that in a very real and practical way every day is a difficult course, and is something that I can't say it's that difficult for me anymore, because actually, when I had cancer, it deformed part of my face and made me look different, although it's quite repaired now. That did, at the very same time I was wondering about my life being gone, I also dealt with, if I live, I'm going to look very differently. But I bring that up because I think that's an area that a lot of women struggle with, and we all have to come to terms with. We could be angry and bitter by that. A third example that's very relevant in my life today is that of my children. I raised my children to be people that I hoped would be godly, I hoped would be thoughtful, I hoped would be wise, I hoped would be kind. And I have a 16-year-old, and I have a 13-year-old and a 9-year-old, and I'm watching them grow up to be their own people. And I only can give them as much as I can give them, and hope and pray for them as much as I can. But I have to submit to what God has in their life. What I'd rather do is control them, is tell them who to be, is direct their behavior in such a way that I looked good. And that's the wrong thing to do. So each day as I raise my children, I have to ask myself, are these God's children, and submit to what he wants for them, or are they my children ultimately? And they're not. And in a very real way, children are going in their own direction. We can either let them do that, or we can bring them to wrath out of our desire to make them what we want them to be, out of our fear of what God has for them.
Because we all have this innate desire to control my own reality, to make reality what I want my reality to be, as if we could be the author of our own existence. That's what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's the opposite of submission. I am not the author of my own existence, of my own life, of my own children. God is the author of everything. But that's why I think one of the very biggest reasons that we rebel against this idea of submission, not just in our relationship, our marriage relationship, but in all our relationships and in all of life. It's a profoundly difficult one to face into.
Yeah.
So when we have this difficult time with it, I think we should say, yeah, that makes sense. That's who we are. Not that we give in to it and say, okay, so I can't work with it. I need to work with it, but it will be a difficult task.
Yeah. I've often thought in trying to think about this issue, since I'm not a woman and don't face the issue of the submission role in a marriage relationship directly, I've often thought, is there any analogy in my own life? And it does strike me that there are a couple of them. On the one hand, I'm a Gentile. And if I look at what the scripture says about who it is that God has appointed to be his people and to be the people that he's going to primarily work through, I'm on the outs of that. He didn't choose my people. He didn't choose Gentiles. He chose the Jews. And I can respond in one of two ways. I can say, well, who does he think he is to be able to be deferential toward this group of people and leave the rest of us on the outs? Well, who he thinks he is God. And who he thinks he is that he has the authority to do that if he wants to. And my problem is, how am I going to respond to that? Am I going to let him be God? Am I going to let him have that authority and favor whom he will favor, grant a role to whomever he will grant the role, grant the authority to whomever he will grant the authority, or not? And just as a sinful human being who might really react to that and rebel against that, I have to come to terms with that by saying, that's okay. He made me a Gentile. He didn't make me a Jew. Same thing with governing authorities. You know, the Bible teaches us to submit to the governing authorities. I think it's very much the same kind of idea. Why didn't God make me president? Well, I don't know, but he didn't. And I'm frankly glad that he didn't. But God chooses whomever he chooses. And whether I like it or not, they have the authority over the nation, and I don't have the authority over the nation. I have to respect and acknowledge that they are in the position of having that authority right now. God appointed some prophets and some apostles. He didn't appoint me either. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not an apostle. Well, why did he pick them and not me? Well, probably a dozen different reasons, but for whatever reason is compelling, he didn't. Can I live with that? Can I accept that? Well, yeah. Do I have a choice? I don't have a choice. God is God, and he's the author of my life and my existence and my role.
You know, I'm also thinking that very often I hear people say, why do I live in poverty?
Right.
And someone else lives in riches, someone sitting right next to me. Why do I have to drive a beat-up car and they get a Mercedes? How come? Why am I infertile and my sister has six children?
Exactly.
Why did I get born with the long nose and my sister was homecoming queen? We can go on and on. The list is endless.
Yeah.
And the question we have to ask in many, many corners and alleyways of our life over and over again is, am I willing to submit to what God gave me?
Yeah. I think what feeds into this, and we've been talking about this, is just being a natural tendency of human beings, and I think it is. I think it becomes particularly amplified and particularly acute in our culture, because as a culture, we have embraced a value of equality and equal opportunity and just this radical kind of democratic ideal that everybody should be able to do anything they want to, and there should be no constraints and no boundaries and no limitations on them. Well, it's obviously very unreal, completely out of touch with reality, not at all It's not even a sane value, particularly if we took it to its logical conclusion. And yet, we embrace it as a whole culture, and it just takes this natural tendency we have to not want any limitations on our life and tries to validate that. So we Americans have a particular hard time with anybody telling us that we can't do something.
Man, that's really an excellent point. That's really true. It's our culture tells us that.
Yeah.
Our American culture tells us that as well. It's just our sinful nature rising up and saying that. So
yeah.
We've got it hard, don't we?
We do.
So you can't blame us that we have a hard time
with
it.
Right.
But of course, we just have to struggle with it more. It's not an excuse not to struggle, not to learn what it is, and to appropriately submit ourselves to submission.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, let's go on. What are some other reasons that submission, the idea of submission, has such a sour taste in our mouth?
Well, I expect the abuses that we have experienced, and that I was asking you earlier about that. You probably have a better experience than I have to speak to that. How do you see it abused?
Well, I think that often, or throughout history, that it would be fair to say that men have dominated women, that has been the reality of things. They've used their power to dominate, to wield power over women, to control them, to make themselves feel good by being better than, to make women less than, to use them and to hurt them with their power. And I think the feminist movement, in large part, is very strong because of the truth of that. That women have been hurt so badly by men, that they're wanting to rise up and say, no more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in reacting against the abusive, coercive power that men have exercised, they think the way to oppose that is to oppose the very concept of headship itself.
And the very concept of submission.
Yeah.
Because to them, it puts them in a weak, very vulnerable, less than position where they will get hurt. And so their anecdote to that is, okay, we'll become strong and we'll become powerful in order to fight against this. We're clenching our fists and we're saying, this will never happen to me again. You will not dominate me.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the concept of submission, misunderstood as it is brought to our minds or we read about it, I think that our first connection is with this abuse of power.
Okay.
And it is reasonably frightening to women because it's not just that historically it's been abused, but it continues to be in many homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard discussions, I think, where in Christian circles where the question arises, if a woman is being literally physically abused, beaten up by her husband, what does the commandment for her to submit to her husband imply for how she should respond to that? And it's discussed in such a way that people actually seriously consider the option that, well, I guess she's supposed to be beaten up. And I think that's what you're saying the feminist movement is reacting to, is that they equate submitting to your husband as being the victim, putting yourself in a position to be victimized, and that's what you're supposed to do. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's the concept of submission at all that the Bible is teaching. I don't think that's the right answer, that if a woman is being abused, she should just accept it and be physically beaten up. I think she should protect herself and get out of there. I think that's what God would have her to do. But what we have to understand about the biblical view of submission is it's only something that is at all relevant in what is a viable, healthy marriage relationship to start with. If the relationship is so broken that a husband is literally physically beating on his wife, that's a relationship that is so broken to start with that headship can't even come into the discussion. We don't even have a partnership to talk about, let alone what's the structure of that partnership. You have to have a partnership before you can decide how it should be organized. But you don't have a partnership when you have a husband beating up on his wife.
Okay, I very much agree with you, but I want to add another piece. Certainly physical abuse is a very obvious mistreatment of another person. But what we need to not overlook is severe emotional abuse, which maybe goes on at least as much or more than physical abuse. The difficulty with emotional abuse is that it becomes somewhat intangible and difficult to put our minds around. It's difficult to say in an emotionally abusive situation what exactly is going on. For many people, they have become so confused and disoriented by what's going on with them. They don't know what's good and what's bad. They don't have a skeleton to hang reasonable thoughts on. They have become, again, very, very confused. In that kind of a situation, women often find themselves in a very vulnerable and very lost kind of situation. Very often they become very isolated. They don't have friends that they talk to. They don't have people that they can relate to and the story to that can give them feedback. And often that's by design, that when if somebody wants to wield power over you, if they can get you in a secret place where you are afraid to talk to anybody, or where the husband says you're not allowed to talk to anybody, and if they believe that that's their rightful submissive role to the head, then they don't talk to anybody. They are even more lost. It's an incredibly tragic situation that many women find themselves in.
Hmm. Yeah, and I would say the same thing about emotional abuse. Physical abuse and emotional abuse is something that a woman needs to stand up against and say to the husband, you have no right. You have no right to hit me. You have no right to physically assault me. You have no right to emotionally abuse me. There is nothing virtuous about just taking it. Now, you know, if we have no recourse, if we have no option, then that's one thing. But to the extent that we have some recourse, we can stand up and say no. A woman has every right and has a moral responsibility, I think, to say no. This is not what you promised me when we got married. This is not what marriage is. And in fact, this is not even decent. This would not be decent in any relationship. This is as evil as it gets, and you must not do that. For your own sake, husband, you must not do that. It's not just self-protection. It's exactly the truth that the husband needs to confront as well.
What do you mean if she has no recourse? What were you getting what were you getting at there?
Well, just that, you know, people may think, well, didn't Jesus teach to turn the other cheek? And didn't Jesus teach to, I mean, didn't
forgive.
By his own and by his own example, didn't he let them hang him on the cross, and didn't he let them beat him and so on? Well, he did, but he was under arrest. I mean, that whole thing is complicated too, because he was voluntarily going to pay for the sins of the world as well. I mean, that was just all part of the humiliation that he voluntarily underwent, because there was this much bigger thing that was at stake. I don't think that you can legitimately find a case where Jesus, apart from the cross, which had higher implications, where Jesus just played the victim. He would submit to the evil of other people at times, but he didn't just allow himself to be victimized for the sake of being victimized. For example, there was a time where the crowd was about to throw him over the cliff at Nazareth because they didn't like what he was saying. He escaped. You know, he didn't take the attitude, well, I am just to be the victim here, and if they're going to throw me over the cliff, they're going to throw me over the cliff. Instead, he escaped through the crowd. It's not clear exactly how he escaped, whether it was supernatural or just slipped away. But in any case, he had recourse. He didn't have to let them throw over the cliff, so he didn't let them do so. That's not in violation of his teaching to turn the other cheek. To turn the other cheek, I think, is just the notion that if you get beaten up on because you got caught in a corner and had no way out, don't retaliate. Don't respond to evil with evil of your own. Don't react evilly in return. If God brought that into your life, then okay, but be merciful. Show compassion and kindness and goodness in return. Don't return evil for evil. I think that's what Jesus is talking about. He's not saying at every opportunity, let people beat up on you.
Well, I'm thinking of an example of turn the other cheek, and let me see if this makes sense to you. I think it's really important, especially in this very dangerous situation of a woman being beat up either emotionally or physically, and I think we need to be clear here. I have an example that I think will be probably understood by the vast majority of mothers, if not fathers, in the audience. It's very, very difficult when our children get hurt or abused or mistreated by other children. That's happened with one of my children in particular, that child really did get hurt by a number of other children. In my heart, what I want to do on one hand is to go and hurt each of them back. It's just something that naturally rises up in me that says, I will hurt you back and I will hurt your parents so that this will never happen to my child again. I want to defend my child. I want to get back at. There's another place in me that says, no, that's wrong. That given the same circumstance, given the same context, given the same experiences, there's no doubt that I would respond like those children's parents, and certainly my son would respond like those children. It is right for me in that case to not hurt them back, to help my child not be in a situation where he'll be hurt, to give him the tools, to give him the understanding, to gather around any kind of help that I can and be very creative about that and very, very active about that. But for me to go back and hurt them would be wrong. What I need to do, what turning the other cheek looks like, is to understand with compassion that I could be like they are, that I could have done that, and to decide not to hurt them back.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very much related to the issue that gets raised by the disciples to Jesus, how many times should we forgive people? And Jesus' response is 70 times 7, or I think he means an unlimited amount. That, if they hit you on the cheek, okay, forgive them that, and don't seek retaliation, don't return evil for evil. But what if they hit you again? Well, what if they hit you on the other cheek? Well, forgive that too. That it the right response doesn't ever come to an end where it ceases to be right to forgive and to be merciful and to not retaliate. That's always right.
It's always right, but I think then we have to go into an understanding of forgiveness, and I certainly will do that in the future. But for right now, forgiveness does not mean putting myself, or in the example that I just used, my child in the position of being hurt. I try and get out of that position of being hurt in whatever ways that I can muster.
Sure.
As a wife, I forgive my husband in the sense that I don't hurt him back, in the sense that I have compassion for the hurt and the sin out of which his abuse comes, and looking at the reality of the situation, I might tell him the truth. Perhaps telling him the truth might be extremely dangerous, and I might not in that situation. But forgiveness does not preclude the possibility that I need to separate myself from the danger.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly.
Okay, let's go on. Jack, last week when we were talking about this, you made a statement that I thought was very interesting. You said that you were talking about the feminists, and you were talking about Abraham in the Bible, and you were kind of comparing them. Can you do that again today?
Yeah, this may seem sort of ironic because I'm by no means I identify with the ideals of feminism as I understand them, but there's an aspect to to what's happened because of the effect of feminism in our culture that I think is very positive, and that is that it has reminded us and brought us to consider what I think is a biblical truth, that the marriage partnership really is a partnership of equals, like I mentioned in the past. If you look at someone like Abraham in the Old Testament, and it's really difficult to say because we don't really have a clear, you know, an exactly clear picture of what Abraham and Sarah's relationship was really like. But to the extent that we could reconstruct that along the lines of what must have been the cultural patterns in that time, it sure looks like Sarah was not really his equal. Probably in that culture, women were looked upon as kind of socially inferior, and their role was not seen as important, and they weren't seen as deserving of the same honor and respect as the men were. To that extent, I think Abraham's relationship with Sarah was unbiblical, that was out of touch with reality, was not as healthy as it could be, was not as appropriate as it should have been, was not as good as it should have been. That may sound shocking to some Christians. I mean, here's the father of our faith. How can he be messing up his marriage so badly? But he was also a slaveholder. Granted, slavery was not then what it was in earlier America, was not quite the cruel institution I think that we saw here in our continent. But nonetheless, slavery is slavery. And I think Abraham was not fully enlightened about the true equality of every human being and the right of every human being to equal dignity, such that somebody should really not be in the undignified position of being owned by someone else. Abraham wasn't enlightened about that. But God did not seem all that concerned to straighten that out right then. He had other things that he wanted to get across to Abraham, and that was the work that he was doing in Abraham's life. I think a similar thing is true of the relationship with Sarah. Sarah deserved probably more dignity than Abraham granted her. I'm not suggesting he was a cruel husband, but he just wasn't enlightened enough to realize the full dignity that Sarah probably deserved. In that respect, the feminist movement has really raised questions that we have had to answer, and I think as Christians we are answering them in a much better way than Abraham did. Yes, that marriage is about people with equal dignity coming together in a partnership of equals.
Thank you. I think that was well said.
Thanks. Given that that's true, I think we have to come to terms with the fact that how a wife's submission to her husband is actually going to work its way out in practical terms, what it's going to look like, is probably going to vary from culture to culture. What it meant for Sarah in relationship to Abraham is different from what it's going to mean in the lives of two Christians who are married to one another in modern times. That is, the Bible is not calling upon us to just kind of live an anachronistic lifestyle and to try to model my life after Sarah. And so if Sarah walked five steps behind Abraham, I walk five steps behind my husband, that kind of thing. We live in a different time and place. And,
now, wait a minute. What does anachronistic mean?
Not in our time, not in our chronology, you know, not belonging to another time. The principle, the two principles that are at stake, I think, are the two that we've been emphasizing. One, we must have, the woman must have sophrosune. She must recognize that God has assigned a role to her husband and a responsibility to her husband that he has not assigned to her, and she must live within the structure that God has created there. And then, secondly, she must respect that role and the authority that goes with that role, and not try to undermine that or sabotage that or disrespect that. That's really all that is biblically required of a woman, I think. Beyond that, each culture is going to work out what that's going to look like in practical terms differently. And within a culture, I think each marriage is going to work out in an individual way how they are going to relate to one another and how they're going to sort out what their roles are and what kinds of symbolic token things are going to be the way that they communicate their respect for that role and so on. For example, Paul says to the women in Corinth, I want you to wear your veils when you are praying and prophesying in church. I want you to wear your veils. Why? Because he thought wearing veils was eternally important for women? No, I don't think so at all. But he thought that that was an important and relevant symbol within their culture. And given that, he didn't want them to symbolically disregard the headship of the husband over the wife. He didn't want them to send the message into their culture that we have no regard for the structure of this relationship that God has created. Well, each culture may have meaningful symbols of the structure of the relationship, and it's not wrong to honor those symbols. It's in most instances right to honor those symbols. So what exactly submission looks like is ultimately going to depend on the culture that we live in.
So can you think of a cultural symbol for women today?
Well, I think, for example, that the feminist movement in its early stages said, you know, why should the wife take the husband's name, last name, when they get married? Why was that important to them? I mean, why is it a big deal whether you do or you don't? Well, I think they took it as symbolic of something, symbolic of some kind of priority that the husband had.
I think for the feminists, a negative, controlling, dominating authority.
Yeah, probably so. Now, I don't know, I'm too close to it to know how to read that culture. I know that from the standpoint of eternal truth, it really doesn't make any difference whether the wife takes the husband's name, the husband takes the wife's name, they keep two different names, they take a third name altogether. None of that really matters. None of that is objectively significant. But it can have more or less importance depending upon what the message is that it's sending to the culture.
Or what it reflects about me.
Yeah. And how I interact with that is going to speak volumes about me and my attitudes. Now, I think we need to be careful. I think there came a point where not taking the husband's name probably became commonplace enough that it may not have meant anything all that significant. Mm-hmm. But there was a time where the only reason you did it is because you were in rebellion against something. And at that point, it would be very important for a woman to ask herself the question, what exactly am I rebelling against if I refuse to take his name? Am I rebelling against the arrangement that God has created? If so, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with my response. If I really am only rebelling against the abuses of it, then it's right to rebel against the abuses of it. But I would also have to ask the further question, is that what other people are going to think I'm rebelling against? Or are they going to read me as rebelling against God himself? And if so, is that the message that I want to send?
In just a moment, Jack and Christine will be back to continue the discussion on headship and submission. So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask the question, what is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job, a career move. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Now, admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center.
Mackenzie was found in the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At Mackenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, and tapes and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber.
So the idea of submission has a very, very sour taste in many of our mouths. We use the word submission and all of a sudden we have this black cloud come over, or this red flame in front of our face. Today we address the question, why is that so? One of the reasons that we discussed was the reason that submission in our marriages is so difficult is because the whole idea of submission generally in our lives is a very difficult one to approach. We want to see ourselves as in charge, as big, as best, as actually the one who's the leader always, and the one that can make decisions about my life however I want, whenever I want, with whatever I want. And that's just not so. The reality is that God is the one that we are submissive to. And He is the one that we need to follow. We need to follow His leading. His leading can lead us into death. It can lead us into poverty. It can lead us into riches. It could lead us into being people who are bright or people that are not very bright. It can lead us into leadership positions or into caretaker positions.
Yeah, that's the spiritual obstacle to our accepting the idea of submission. I think there's also an emotional obstacle for someone who doesn't react to it or is not hostile to it because of a spiritual rebellion. They may have an emotional obstacle to it because they've seen it abused so much that in their minds they can't separate true submission in a biblical sense from the power and mastery and exploitation of men over women. And I think there can also be an intellectual obstacle to some people that they have just not become clear enough on how to define the biblical concept of headship and the corresponding concept of submission, that it's very, very difficult for them to see that it doesn't imply that a woman somehow is an inferior dignity. And I think if we rightly understand the concept, it does not imply that at all. So But that can be an obstacle to people if they don't see how and why it does not have that implication.
And again, in that regard, I'd like to refer people to our last week's discussion on submission. I think having a really right understanding of what it is very, very core to being able to live peacefully with the idea of submission and headship.
Thank you, Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. As we close today's program, the teachers and students at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College have an invitation for you. It would delight them if you would join them in their quest for righteousness, wisdom, and true human fulfillment. As they prepare their studies and dialogues, they know they are in deep need of God's continuing grace and mercy. Their prayer is that their teaching will, in some way, be valuable to others. If you would like to sample other examples of Mackenzie Study Center ministries, it's easy to do. Just ask for the monthly paper News and Views, or ask for the catalog of tapes and papers. Let me give you a phone number and the mailing address. You may call area code 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Or write to Christianity at Work, 1883 University, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. Again, the phone number is area code 541-485-4801. This program and the other ministries of Mackenzie Study Center are made possible through the generous gifts of Christian people who have come to appreciate the biblical perspective on reality provided by the Study Center staff. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week when Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber will engage in another provocative dialogue.